it's a new year, so it's time for a new note-taking solution.
Oh, no, not again. The perennial podcast episode.
Yes, I'm sorry.
Are you now writing it down in a book?
No, although someone did wave a notebook at me on a Zoom call at work the other day. And I was like, no, don't do it. Don't tempt me. And they were like, show me the pages. I was like, no, stop it. I'll end up buying one and it'll be yet another book with two or three pages filled in and then the rest blank. So no, I'm not doing that. No, I'm going to wave a bon voyage to markdown files in a folder.
Right.
And I'm going to say a jolly hello to markdown files in a self-hosted Docker container somewhere.
Well, that sounds a lot simpler. What's going on?
So previously, what I was doing up until this point was using a text editor to edit markdown files in a directory that used sync thing to synchronize between all my computers that I care about, which is quite a decent solution. And it has worked, but I have had trouble solving the problem of a really good editor for editing those markdown files. And by really good editor, what I mean is I put a note together every week. I run a script which creates a note from a template which has Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday stabbed out. And there's a few things in each day that I always do every week. And then I flesh out what I'm going to do that week, like fill in the gaps. And the thing that helps me is to use the markdown check marks, a little square bracket with a space and another square bracket, and then the thing. And then I can just put an X in it and it's like checked off. And so if I'm reading this markdown in anything other than a text editor, I can see the check marks next to the things that I've done and the empty check marks next to the things I haven't done, which all sounds great. But I tend to use a text editor that is raw text. Like I've used Sublime Text and I've used VS Code recently. And so I'm looking at the raw markdown. And so all I'm really seeing is square bracket X, square bracket. I'm not seeing a little checkbox with a, you know, with a button that I press, and I don't get the benefit of it being like a form on a page. Now I could have split screen view, but I actually don't like having two panes scrolling vertically at the same time because actually they never scroll at the same time because of the way the formatting works. They're all a little bit janky and not quite right. But I do like to sometimes switch to the markdown rendered view. And I know there's ways to preview in VS Code, but it wasn't jiving with me. And I was finding myself losing files and stuff was just getting a bit of a mess. So I decided to deploy Kodi MD, which is, you may remember HackMD of the past, which is basically multiplayer notepad in a web browser. And so I deployed one of those on a machine and I point my web browser at it wherever I am, and it's within my tailscale tailnet. So I'm the only person who can see it because it's not exposed to the outside world. It's only visible from all my machines and not from anywhere else. And so I don't feel scared about someone stumbling on all my notes because it's only visible inside my network, right?
Your private poetry.
All my very important shopping lists. And, you know. Reasons why I should marry Kylie Minogue.md and all these other markdown files that are very important. So yeah, that's what I've done. And I've only been doing this for about a week, but I quite like it. And I like how easy it was to deploy Kodi MD. The documentation works. It's grab a Docker file, edit a couple of lines, start it up. That's it. Done. There's some configuration options you can fiddle with, and they're all very well documented. It's all very easy to set up. And that's it. I've got a web browser. I can point at a thing, and in there are my notes.
How do you back up and or like sync what you've got in your Kodi to somewhere for in case you destroy that container by accident?
Well, two things. Synchronization is not a backup. You know that, Martin. So I don't have to worry about synchronization, that part. Because whereas I was previously editing files that were sat in a sync thing synchronized folder, sometimes sync thing wouldn't be running somewhere and a machine would be out of date and then it would have to catch up and that was annoying. Whereas this is all in a central place, which right now is a machine sat behind me on the desk, which is an HP microserver of yore. ye olde microserver, N40L or something, or N54 or something like that. So it's pretty old and crusty. It's not the fastest machine on the planet. I will probably move this to something else. I've got one of those Dell thin client things. Might put it on that. Might be a bit faster because the CPU is a bit weedy in the HP microserver. In terms of backups, I do backups using Borg. And so I can backup stuff, no problem whatsoever. So I've taken away the need for the synchronization by having it in a central place. And I can access it on my phone as well because I've got Tailscale on my phone. And that's on the tailnet. And so I can just point a browser at it and I can even bookmark it. So I've got a little button in my list of applications on my mobile phone and I can get straight to my notes.
You said you have moved to editing Markdown files in a Docker container. Does Kodi MD actually store your notes as Markdown files on disk, or is it in a like a database within the application or something?
That's a great question. And I don't actually know how it stores it. I think there's a database underneath it because there's two containers. One's Kodi MD and one's, I think it's Postgres.
Right.
So almost certainly there's Postgres. But the nice thing is there's little buttons in the top right-hand corner where you can like export stuff out and render it and all that kind of good stuff. I haven't explored that. Like I said, I've only been using it about a week and I'm quite happy with it so far. I'm just taking it for a test drive at the moment. But it's overall, I'm quite happy with it. I quite like the fact that if I want to, I can just press the button at the top and just view it as a rendered page, which is handy if I'm writing a blog post because we use WordPress. And so I can, well, technically we use WP Engine. Less said about that, the better. but if I write a blog post in Markdown, then I know I can render it and see it pretty much as it will look in inverted commas, WordPress. And I can give that URL to somebody else if I'm using a public Kodi MD or something like that, if we want to share something. But most of this is just my own private notes, and I'm getting on with it quite well.
I have embarked on an epic adventure to the Caves of Cud.
Ooh. Is that a horizontally scrolling shoot 'em up?
Oh, Alan, behave. Now, Mark, is it a racing game?
Of course, yes.
Racing through the Caves of Cud.
Classic racing circuits through caves.
Exactly what I was thinking. I can imagine it now.
So no, this is not just a game with roguelike elements. This is a fully blown old school style roguelike, but at a modern scale, I think I'll say.
Okay, so you say a full blown roguelike. So this means permadeath, but you keep experience as you die and progress through the world. Is that right?
No, as in permadeath, you start again.
You start again with nothing.
Apart from the knowledge that you gained from your previous run.
Right.
So this is okay. Up there with the old school NetHacks and Angband and games like that.
Okay. And you said that this is on a scale of the modern world or the modern era. What do you mean by that?
Well, so the game has a fixed overworld, which you can see, and you can sort of fast travel across the world and go into local areas, which are each a tile on the map. And that's a fixed overworld, and it's vast, but then within each of those, there's a sort of procedurally generated local cells, which have things to discover in, like, well, caves, for one, hence the name Caves of Cud.
I would be disappointed if it lacked caves.
Yeah, settlements, monsters, loot, that sort of thing lying about for you to explore in each area. And that is obviously completely different each time, and you can generate new characters each time, so your experience differs and so on.
So what's the difference between this and literally every other roguelike game?
Well, the setting is unique. It's got a sort of sci-fi, post-apocalyptic kind of setup. You're either player as something called a mutated human or something called a true kin, but you're in this sort of desolate wasteland without many people, sort of different biomes, but they're all a bit hostile to life and things like that. Lots of different options for what happens to your character. So you can have your character can mutate as you level up. You have skills and skill trees a bit more like something like an Elder Scrolls type game. So as you level up, you get skill points to buy different skills in different areas, and then they sort of build up as you go up that area of the skill tree. So things like using different types of weapons, cooking, traveling without getting lost, that kind of thing.
Is it single player, or can multiple people partake in this fun?
I only really play games by myself. So as far as I know, it's only single player. I can't really see how it would work as a multiplayer. I suppose you could explore together, but I haven't actually looked into it. There could be a multiplayer option I've not seen.
I have a vague recollection. I might have played this in the past when it first came out. And I have a feeling I was playing with other people, or maybe I was just playing on my own and watching other people on a stream or something. I don't know. I'm old.
I took a look at the website for this because I saw this in the show notes, and you see something like Caves of Quad and it's like, what the heck is this going to be? So I better take a look. This game has been in development for a very long time.
Yes. Yeah. Apparently over a decade, something like that.
15 years, I think. First version was in 2007, and I think it went Steam green light, what is it, early access in 2015.
Right. So yes, I hadn't heard of it until it went to final release, so that's why I've only started playing it recently.
Right.
But yeah, you can see that it's been a long time in the making. There's a lot of detail to it. It's using pixel art graphics that are kind of reminiscent of sort of maybe the early Ultima games. Mm-hmm. It's characters, but very low res. But then it does lots of interesting things like applying colour to things to show that they're stained with different liquids like blood or slime or sap. And there's also kind of pixel art effects that happen. So as you walk through water, the tiles around you splash and get covered with whatever you've walked through. And there might be like wind, and you see sort of things in a very sort of, yeah, low frame rate, low resolution way blow across the screen, reminiscent, yeah, sort of DOS era games like this. And there's a lot of depth to it as well.
And you move very similar to old school roguelikes where you move based on a block.
Yes.
But some of the videos I've seen on the Steam page look like they're hexagonal as well as square.
No, so you can move in like eight directions. But the slightly weird thing is, so I'm playing it on the Steam Deck with a controller, and because it's turn-based, you don't want to just push the stick to the left and then you zoom across the screen, or you like zoom into an enemy that then hits you 50 times. So in order to keep that turn-based tick, what you do is you point the stick, and then you get a little arrow around your character saying which way you're facing, and then you pull the trigger, and then that moves you one tile or attacks once in that direction. You can also map it so that, you know, you press on the D-pad and you go that way. But I think they wanted to, because one of the things in like NetHack, you don't want to lean on a key in NetHack because you end up dying very quickly. So I think that was their attempt to sort of balance being able to play it well on a controller, but also being able to keep the turn-based element working. It feels a bit funny at first, and there's a lot to the interface. So when it's taking you through the tutorial, there's a lot like, okay, you know, press this button to do this thing over here on the screen and this to do this thing on the screen. And now you have to like hold one trigger and press one button. And there's all prompts on the screen that show you, but it is quite a lot to take in. I did think at first when I was playing the tutorial, I'm not going to get on with this. But then as soon as it finished and I just tried doing the half a dozen actions you actually need to play the game, you get used to it quite quickly.
It has a very CoPage 437 vibe to it.
It does.
But with, like, it breaks that. Like, if this was trying to enter a contest of a, you know, 8-bit style game, yeah, it would fail because it, like, it has high resolution
stuff. High resolution.
And, like, fast.
Yes.
Yeah. And over the top of the, like, the main gameplay area, which is all, like, big tiles.
Exactly.
And,
yeah,
like, big pixels. I like that, like, mix of both, yeah, so it's not just 8-bit style.
It is a bit like a high-resolution Zelda, like original Zelda.
Original Zelda, yeah. So you get, like, a window, a portion of the screen is the game world, and then, yeah, you have, like, a lot of UI around it, which is higher res and has all the text in. So you're not reading like, yeah, blocky text. You've actually got stuff in a reasonably well presented format.
And how much time have you put into the game? And do you have any idea as to how long it's going to take to complete your quest?
So I started off playing it in permadeath mode. So the game has different modes. It has permadeath mode, a role play mode, which is where it's the same as permadeath, except you get checkpointing when you enter and leave a settlement. So if you go to a town which are peaceful, then, you know, if you die during your next adventure, you start back at that town with everything you had then, rather than going right back to the start. So a little bit more forgiving. Then there's exploration mode, which is more of the sort of, if you just want to explore the story, you don't have to fight as much. You have other ways of leveling up. And then they do like a daily build where you everyone plays the same daily character. So I started off playing permadeath mode, and I played for probably 3 or 4 hours on that just to kind of get my head into the game and understand what it was I was supposed to be doing. But it is absolutely brutal, especially near the start of the game. If you're trying to learn how to play on permadeath mode, you're going to be there a long time, I think. So I switched to role play, and I've probably put in about another 4 or 5 hours worth on role play mode. I've now got myself to a point where I kind of understand all of the, you know, the weapons and the skills and the mechanics of the game. Still dying occasionally. I'm not dying of things like thirst or hunger anymore, because I've got the hang of what you're supposed to do to avoid that. But, you know, running into enemies that I wasn't prepared for and things like that are still common occurrences. I mean, I've explored probably about 2% of the map at this point. So yeah, I don't know what's going on. It's a very, very strange world. There's sort of the hints of a story. I've done a couple of quests, and I've been sent off to a place to find some people. I assume that's a plot that's going to happen, but I have no idea what's going on or what any of this other fantastical looking stuff I can see on the world map might turn out to be.
It sounds like you're still on like season 1, episode 2 of this thing.
Yeah.
This adventure.
I mean, I feel like the Elder Scrolls games always talk about having like a stepping out moment where you're like, you're in the beginning of the game and selecting a character and working through the first area. And then you step out into, oh, that's the extent of this world. And I understand now what kind of game this is. And I feel like I've not quite got to that stepping out point on this game.
Right.
But I only bought this to sort of fill in, because there's another game that's coming out in February, which I wanted to play. And this was like meant to be I'll just play a bit of a roguelike to have something to do for a little while. But now I feel like I might be getting deeper into this than I intended.
Oh gosh. I was playing with my Steam Deck, more on that in a later episode. Just today, I think I might have to reinstall Chaos of Cud and have a play with it. Oh God. Oh, all right, then, I will.
I've been going total command line mode with KMS Con.
Total command line. It's not a Hollywood blockbuster, is it?
No, it's definitely not.
I was going to say, KMS Con does sound a lot like something from an 80s hacker movie.
Oh, yeah, it does, I suppose. Yeah, yeah. We're not far off the mark there, actually. So KMS Con is a virtual console emulator for the Linux console. So not in a window manager, but actually the console, that text thing, you know, that we see briefly from time to time.
So my first question is, why do you want to emulate a console when you're already in a console?
Well, this is a replacement console. So you get the standard Linux console, which is quite limited. And the reason that I first started using KMS Con is that it has a number of modern features. The first is that it uses Pango for crisp font rendering. So that means that it uses TrueType and OpenType fonts, as opposed to, I can't remember what the name of the sort of the fixed pixel fonts are that the traditional console uses.
So this means you can have super high quality rendering of your awful fixed CIS Excelsior font that you choose to use in the terminal.
It does mean that fixed CIS Excelsior is a thing in my console now. But it goes further than that, because it uses like a proper font rendering tool, because Pango under the covers uses font config and all the rest of it. What that also means is the common binding for zooming like a regular terminal in a window also works. So if you are on a very high resolution display, like what the three of us have, the LG Jewel Up, you can control shift plus and you can zoom the font in and off you go. You have nice big readable fonts.
Sorry, a narrator's note just for the audience. Every time Martin mentions a key combo, he always looks at the keys as he says them. And I just caught him looking down at his control key as he said control alt.
Yeah.
I love it. Yeah. I love this.
It's a fact. Now, what using Pango fonts means is that in addition to having fonts that zoom, it also means that UTF-8 is a thing. Now, UTF-8 is great and everything, but what that actually really means is emojis and nerd fonts work using KMS Con.
See previous episode about Starship, right?
Right. So that turned out to be very popular. Thank you for everyone that's commented on my GitHub gist about my Starship configuration. It's like a small community of people over there getting that working on different things. So more importantly, if you're using a language that has complex characters like Chinese, Korean, or Japanese, then those also work properly using KMSCon. So that's all fantastic.
I feel I should represent the concerned listener who thinks, what is he bagging on about? I only ever see the terminal when my computer has gone wrong and I'm seeing an init RD prompt or init RAMFS prompt, or I'm being told to log in on the terminal because my NVIDIA driver packaging is rubbish or something like that. Like, why on earth would you want your KMSCon thing to be front and center? What? Why?
One of the benefits is that because it's using the kernel and DRM and KMS, which basically means it uses Mesa's acceleration libraries, the same things that are used by the desktop environments and their display servers. So as a result, you get flicker-free booting, for example, because it only has to switch that graphics mode once, because it's the same graphics mode used for everything. And on those rare occasions that you do want to switch from your desktop environment to switch VTs to one of the virtual consoles, it does that instantaneously without the usual herk and jerk, because it's the same resolution for everything everywhere.
So what's actually involved in switching to something like this? Is this like part of like rebuilding your initRD system so that it's there? Or is it just install a package and it'll run that boot instead of whatever it normally runs, or something in between?
First, you install NixOS.
I mean, more generally, where does this sit in the system?
Yes. So KMSCon is available for the various Linux distributions. You can find it. I will add that if you just go and randomly Google for KMSCon, you will find all of the ancient references to KMSCon from like 10, 12 years ago. There is a fork. We have a link to that current version, which has been updated and maintained. But in short, when you install it, yes, there's a piece that integrates with the initial RAM disk and also systemd, so multi-seat and everything is integrated. So it's part of the integrated boot process once it's installed and configured. And yes, if you are using NixOS, you can just say kmscon.enable equals true, and you don't have to worry about any of that stuff. But there are packages in Ubuntu for, I think, about 5 or 6 releases now. So, you know, it's in there. I've seen it in Arch. So it's available for the distributions.
So on a normal Linux distro, you could just like apt or yum or whatever install KMSCon. And the next time you reboot, like that will magically make your terminal look nicer and be less flickery.
Yes.
Huh.
Now, all of that aside, all of those benefits that I've just described, what I've actually been thinking about is we routinely talk about our little voyages through modern Unix and these cool utilities with their pseudo-graphical graphing and interesting user interfaces presented in the terminal. And my mind is going to a place with, imagine a distro that has no desktop, that you boot and you get dropped into KMSCon with font zooming, with each virtual terminal as a, in air quotes, workspace, and all of the tooling that you would usually use just all back like it used to be in the 1990s in a glorious text interface.
I mean, that's like Arch Linux, isn't it? Like, I guess. I was trying to figure out what I would say. Would I say, well, that's Ubuntu Core, isn't it? But I thought that was too niche. But if I said Ubuntu Arch Linux, everyone knows that, like, the default is you get a black screen with white text, right? And but you're going beyond that. You're saying you want it to be beautiful and functional and have all of the applications and all of the productivity stuff. I can see a world where that should exist, yes.
Yes, so that's what I'm thinking about. But whilst I think about journeying into this pure text sort of world, it has some benefits. for using it in conjunction with, you know, your regular Linux desktop. And it's something I've been using for about 18 months or so now. I've had it in the backlog of things to talk about on the podcast for absolutely ages. So I decided to pull it out. So I've been using it for a good long while, and it's just one of those little sort of, it's a bit of polish and quality to sort of, you know, your Linux experience that is closer to sort of those polished experiences that you get on something like macOS, where they control that whole boot and graphical transition process when you turn your computer on. It's just nice. And so I thought I'd share it because it's available everywhere now, at least the modern fork with all the updates is available everywhere. And it's worth checking out.